Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will proclaim the Lord's decree. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and celebrate his rule with trembling. Kiss the son, or he will be angry, and your way will lead to your destruction. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. All right, can anyone name the psalm that I just read? Psalm 2? All right, is that because you know the psalm or because you remember last week I said we'd be doing Psalm 2? All right, so let's turn there. Before we work through its contents, I want to spend some time on some introductory comments and kind of an overview of it. Last Sunday, as you will remember, we looked at Psalm 1, and I shared how I had in earlier weeks of my conversion a special connection with that particular psalm, and that, again, was many years ago. But Psalm 2 is one that I'm having a special connection with currently. There are specific lines in this psalm that I've been reciting to myself quite a bit in the past month or so, especially when watching the news or reading the paper. And this is something that I, you know, actually really like about the Psalms, that you can always find one to connect with, regardless of what you're feeling or going through, whatever's, you know, stage you're experiencing. If there are certain emotions being stirred within you, joy, anger, gratitude, worry, frustration, depression, love for God, hope, you know, well, among the 150 psalms in the Psalter, there will be at least one of them that you'll be able to connect with. Reading it, pondering it, quoting it back to yourself, praying it, this sort of thing can not only be personally therapeutic, good for the soul, but the central message of the psalm, whatever it might be, you know, how to think about this or that can help keep us on the right track. You know, avoid attitudes and behavior that would be outside God's will. Psalm 2 has kept me from going postal, all right? So much of what is happening in the world today is both frightening and infuriating. Every day there seems to be something that causes great concern. One moment I feel a surge of panic, then a surge of anger, then a surge of despair. Sometimes I, quite frankly, want to go off the grid, buy a 5-year supply of food and ammo, and build a 30-foot concrete wall around my property. Other times I want to go on the offensive, and maybe I don't want to share what that looks like. It could jeopardize my current employment. My fear and anger and despair has been tempered here in recent weeks by, of all things, poetry. Psalm 2, when you look at it, really doesn't offer anything new to the table. The truths and lessons in it are ones we all know, frontwards and backwards. What Psalm 2 does, however, is to take those well-known, take-it-for-granted truths and presents them in a different package where one can appreciate them in a new light. In this case, poetry, images, drama. And for someone who scores an absolute zero on the artsy scale, well, that says something about Psalm 2, doesn't it? The nations and its rulers will revolt against God's truths and God's ways and God's law. They will spare no effort in denying God his rightful authority as creator and Lord. They will throw off their shackles, try to. What God calls good, they will call evil. What God calls evil, they will call good. And in this, the Lord is unmoved. He doesn't negotiate with rebels, nor concerns himself with their threats, nor adjusts himself to suit their demands, but simply reaffirms his royal plan. I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. All authority has been given to Christ, who rules and reigns over the universe at God's right hand. His throne cannot be overthrown. His divine plan cannot be sabotaged. In the end, God's ultimate purposes will be carried out through his son Jesus, whether rulers and kings and governors submit to him or not. Again, we're all grounded in these truths of Christ's power, of his unshakable kingdom, and what all that means. They are addressed extensively in the New Testament, but the poetry and images and drama of Psalm 2 are quite effective in speaking those truths to us on a different level. This psalm begins like a story in the middle of things. We do not know who the speaker is or to whom the speaker is addressing. It starts off with a question there in verse 1. Why are the nations threatening God and his people? Typically, we would be compelled to try and figure that out. What is the actual situation here? The historical setting. I mean, this would be the natural place to start. That's what we teach here. But in this case, there doesn't appear to be one. The psalm reflects different aspects of Israel's life, but the details don't really match up with any particular event that we know of. For one, Israel never enjoyed such an extensive empire that all of these kings and nations were brought under its control and forced against their will to submit to God's law. And so the psalm here should be best viewed as something called a redemptive historical drama. And as such, it gives the people of God a theological perspective for interpreting world events, that such events need not be a cause of panic or despair. And verse 1 then is actually a rhetorical question. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? Well, because they hate God's claim that he has authority over them, and they foolishly believe that they can remove themselves from that. The psalm actually invites us to imagine a situation like the one it describes, to picture a hypothetical situation where God rules the kingdoms of the earth through his chosen nation Israel and her anointed king. And then the audacity of these human rulers to think that they could actually pull off such a successful revolt. And this story or drama is used to present valuable lessons and principles about God's authority and his divine plan, and his relationship with his people, and the commitment he makes to Israel's king, and his resolve to both judge rebellious nations and reward those who honor him. God's sovereignty is front and center in Psalm 2. And again, these lessons are powerfully portrayed in images that are used. I mean, these images leave quite an impression. Nations conspiring together. You can visualize that. The Lord enthroned in heaven. The Lord laughing at such nonsense, and that laughing turning to wrath. What an image. God installing his chosen king on Zion, his holy mountain. That chosen king ruling with an iron rod and smashing his enemies like one would smash fragile pottery. Again, vivid images. And that this king is portrayed as his son, one God has anointed and relates to his father. And there is this kissing of the son, kissing his feet as in a sign of submission. And the warning that the wrath of the Son can flare up in a moment. Admittedly, these images are not as precise as literal language, but whatever is lost in precision is gained in vividness of expression. For instance, we could say that one's enemy is cruel, unpredictable, and crazy. We could use literal language. But it is just as accurate, though not as precise, to say that the enemy is like a wild baboon. The picture of a wild baboon speaks to us more fully than straight facts. Many times, images stir our emotions, attract our attention, and stimulate our imaginations. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. I mean, what a picture. I love imagining that whole scene. What a way to convey just how serious God takes their threats of rebellion. It amuses him. At the heart of Psalm 2 is a divine commitment, a commitment that God made to David through the prophet Nathan, which is spelled out in both 1 Chronicles and 2 Samuel. And understanding that promise is essential in appreciating the meaning of the psalm itself. We'll discuss this more when we get to verses 7 through 9, but essentially it is this promise that David's line will always reign, that one of his descendants would always rule as king of Israel. And in this, God also promised that he would have a father-son relationship with that king, support him, stand behind him, defeat his enemies, and make him the greatest king in the world, and thus make him a witness to God's might and purpose. And as his adopted son, this king and his kingdom is destined to rule the world on God's behalf. That was the royal plan. And based on this, it is therefore believed that this psalm was used in the coronation ceremonies of these kings, a kind of reminder to God's chosen people and to the one now about to occupy the throne of God's commitment, of his support and backing, to not panic when nations conspire against them, but to instead join the Lord in laughing, that such threats cannot be taken seriously given the divine promise and their privileged standing. But more importantly, it was also seen as a prophecy, especially later on, in the aftermath of the exile, with the destruction of Israel's national identity and hopes. Many of the psalms, like this one, were seen in a deeper light, as prophecies about a future age and the reign of a promised Messiah. What the human kings of Israel and Judah were unable to do because of their sin and rebellion toward God, God would do through his anointed one, a Messiah, a king who would truly be his son. And so Psalm 2 is ultimately a prophecy about God's royal plan regarding Jesus. And there are, of course, a number of references in the New Testament declaring that very thing, that Jesus of Nazareth is the fulfillment of Psalm 2. In fact, it is one of the most quoted psalms in the New Testament. We could easily speculate that Psalm 2 is a topic of discussion on the Emmaus Road, when Jesus explained all that had been written about him in the law, the prophets, and the Psalms. So with that introduction and overview in mind, let's take a closer look at the contents itself and its application. But first, let's read through it again now that you have it opened there in your Bibles. And I'll be reading out of the NIV. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will proclaim the Lord's decree. He said to me, you are my son. Today I become your father. Ask me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and celebrate his rule with trembling. Kiss the Son, or he will be angry, and your way will lead to your destruction. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. All right, well, as you can see in your own Bible, the psalm is divided into four equal sections, four stanzas, each having three lines. The first stanza, verses 1 through 3, have the, here we have the international conspiracy, the revolt. And the second stanza, verses 4 through 6, we have God's response to that. And the third stanza, verses 7 through 9, we have the affirming of the covenant of kingship. And in the fourth stanza, 10 through 13, we have the warning to the nations. We'll start with the first stanza, the international conspiracy. Since the kings and rulers of the earth do not really acknowledge God and his authority, they have no allegiance to him and certainly no allegiance to his law. And as to be expected, they find the moral constraints of his righteousness a threat to their to what they want to do. They want freedom, freedom to live and rule as they want, freedom to call evil good and good evil. They want to be the ones to define right and wrong for those that they rule over. And so they plot together to break the chains and throw off their shackles, to rid themselves of God's moral demands upon them, the constraints of his righteousness. The psalmist is astonished that these rulers would even try such a thing. The same idea can be expressed as, why do the nations bother, given that such an attempt would surely be in vain? Indeed, their revolt is nothing but noise. In today's culture, this revolt against God among the rulers of the nations is seen in their efforts of stripping away religious freedoms, legalizing, promoting, and funding the killing of preborn babies, normalizing and advancing same-sex marriage and other perversions and forcing the masses to accept that, beheading Christians, criminalizing evangelism and Christian parenting, and so on. The list just goes on and on. At the heart of it is a drive to rid our society of God and His influence and His authority. The powers to be do not want a king over them. They want that role for themselves. They want to be the final arbiter of right and wrong and impose their standard upon those they govern. Just this last week, Hillary Clinton, a wannabe world leader, was promoting the advancement of abortion at some event and was complaining that legalized abortion is not enough and that more must be done to see, quote, reproductive rights move forward in this country. In other words, according to her, we are not killing enough babies. One of the obstacles to this, she noted, was, does anyone know the story? Was what? Religious beliefs. That's an obstacle. And went on to say that such religious beliefs have to be changed. Her words. Implying, of course, that this is what her campaign intends to do. Well, I have to wonder, what would you do to change our religious beliefs? If you became president, would you launch some campaign to discredit the scriptures, its teachings on the sanctity of life? Would you use your executive powers to outlaw the Bible if necessary? Make it illegal to have sermons condemning abortion? Close down churches that do not have a pro-choice provision in their statement of faith? Or something more subtle, like use your buddies in Hollywood to ridicule pro-lifers in the movies and on television? But I guess they've already been doing that, haven't they? All right. Also, this past week, the Solicitor General of the U.S. was arguing before the Supreme Court, trying to persuade the justices to make same-sex marriage the law of the land and impose it upon all 50 states. The Solicitor General was asked if doing so would have any religious freedom ramifications. Justice Alito presented it this way. A while back, the IRS revoked the tax-exempt status of the Bob Jones University for its policy against biracial marriages. Would schools and religious organizations and churches lose its tax-exempt status if they had policies against same-sex marriages? The Solicitor General stumbled and eventually admitted, quote, it's going to be an issue. Well, what makes this so alarming is that, again, this week, as you know, y'all know this, a judge in Oregon ordered a Christian baker to pay $135,000 in damages to a lesbian couple for refusing to bake a cake for their wedding. $135,000. So the answer to Justice Alito's question is obvious. Of course there's going to be religious liberty ramifications. And so when I hear all this stuff, you know, I begin to panic. I really do. And then I get angry. Maybe I get angry first and panic. I'm not real sure. And then I just get depressed. But, you know, it's nothing more than that same old nonsense that Psalm 2 talks about. This absurd thinking that puny humans can strip the Almighty One of His authority and possess it for themselves. Yet another conspiracy against God, God's law, and God's people. Sure, the ungodly rulers of this age may get their way. They may get it now. You and I might fight with all we have against their efforts to destroy our society with their devil-filled plans, and we may fail in our efforts. They may run over us like a steamroller. But their breaking the chains of moral restraint is only for a moment, only a temporary setback in the bigger picture. God's ultimate plan is not affected, His authority not compromised. They are like grasshoppers trying to move the earth off its axis by jumping up and down. They might bend a small blade of grass, but even that will spring back a few moments later. Nothing they will do will have any lasting significance. The Lord laughs at their efforts and will, on the appointed day, terrify them in His wrath. The confidence of God's people rests in God Himself, who is unmoved by the political plots and schemes and conspiracies that those on earth devise against His authority. Now, this is not to be understood as God not caring. Indeed, he cares greatly, as we will see in the next stanza. But his caring is demonstrated by his sticking to the royal plan, which itself is a plan to restrain evil and crush rebellion for all eternity. So let's turn there. The second stanza, and here we go to the divine response. Verse 4. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath. Or the word there is actually burning rage, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. Well, again, the Lord neither negotiates with rebels, nor worries about their threats, nor adjusts himself to suit their demands. Again, he simply reaffirms his royal plan. Bottom line, there's nothing to be alarmed about. God's determination to establish his king and his kingdom is not in any way weakened by the noise of his opposition. The words, the one enthroned in heaven, are not meant to convey, as some might think, that God is far removed from the fray and therefore uninterested. Rather, it addresses his exaltation and supreme power that is literally out of this world. To think that they can succeed in any plot against him is just downright funny. It's laughable. But though the thought itself is funny, the rebellion isn't. And this prophecy that he will terrify them with his wrath is one that is repeated throughout the scriptures. And it will fully come to pass, again, according to the scriptures, when Jesus, quote, returns from heaven in blazing fire with his powerful angels. And so again, God's response is to simply reaffirm his plan. I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. There is nothing anyone can do to change that. My king will rule, and he will crush all revolts and bring all nations into submission. Evil will be restrained. My plan for righteousness and peace will triumph, all in my perfect time. Everything now is headed toward that end. And so in the present age, he scoffs at them. But when he returns from heaven in blazing fire, he will not be laughing. Rather, he will mete out justice in all of its terror and fury and wrath. We do not see that justice now, but it will come. Thus, as we talked about a month ago, the prayer, Thy kingdom come, which is a prayer for evil to end, for righteousness to reign, a prayer for the faithful to be rewarded, and for the arrogant and godless kings and rulers to answer for their crimes against God and against those they ruled over. A day when the raging of nations and their conspiracies will cease. May it come soon. May it come soon. Third stanza, verses 7 through 9, the covenant of kingship. I will proclaim the Lord's decree. He said to me, You are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Well, this passage takes a little explanation. I talked about it a little bit at the beginning. The issue here is God's relationship to the Davidic kings of Israel, David's descendants. It is described in terms of sonship, which comes from the 7th chapter of 2 Samuel, where God, through Nathan, tells David that after he dies, God will raise up from among his offspring a king, and that God himself will establish that, will establish the kingdom of that king, and that he will be to him a father, and he shall be to, and he shall be to God as a son, and that the throne of his kingdom will endure forever and his enemies defeated. That prophecy is also found in 1 Chronicles 17. And so the psalmist recalls this and states it as the Lord's decree and an official declaration from on high. Now, the prophecy of Nathan that this decree is found in has actually kind of a double meaning. In one sense, it is fulfilled by the fact that David did have offspring who ruled as kings over Israel and later Judah. And to some degree, God did have a father-son relationship with them in the sense that they enjoyed a special power and privilege. Here, sonship should be understood in a particular sense. God showed favor to these kings, adopted them, and they ruled on his behalf, and therefore were considered anointed or chosen. Having the standing of a son, they enjoyed the exclusive right to rule over God's people in the same way a son would rule over a father's estate. Verse 7 does, we just have to understand it in that context. It is all about this prophecy Nathan made to David and the promises contained in that prophecy. And the word today, as in today I've become your father, would be referring to the day of coronation, when a new king would be crowned, anointed to assume the throne. But as we know, the kingdom of David did eventually fall. The kings that ruled Israel and Judah were, for the most part, unfaithful to God, as were the people they ruled, and God allowed their enemies to defeat them and take them captive. And this then brings us to the second meaning of Nathan's prophecy, something we technically call the sensus plenior, which just means the fuller sense or the ultimate fulfillment, which of course is found in Jesus Christ. The ancient king served as a foreshadow of the true king who was yet to come. And Jesus, of course, is the ultimate fulfillment of Nathan's words referred to here in Psalm 2. As we know, he is biologically David's offspring. And as we know, he rules as Lord of all, seated at the right hand of the Father in heaven itself. Again, a number of New Testament passages clearly assert this and point to verse 7 of Psalm 2 in that. And the reference to, you are my son, today I become your father, therefore take on a deeper appreciation. For Jesus is not just appointed to rule, not just appointed to fulfill the role of son as one who rules on his father's behalf, or some sort of adopted son in a temporary function, but truly is God's one and only son, a unique son who shares the same divine nature with the Father. And in keeping with the original intent of Nathan's prophecy, this universal reign that Jesus has as Lord of the nations enjoys the full support and backing of God the Father. The one enthroned in heaven stands behind him, promises to bless and empower him, has committed himself to his success, amens his policies and plans and the administration of his divine government. You know, whatever you need to fulfill this task, ask of me, and it will be yours. The full resources of this department are at your disposal, kind of thing. The nations themselves, they belong to you. Those who rebel, you can smash them like fragile pottery. Here is a king who is truly God's son and enjoys that relationship as it was always intended. Here is a king worth submitting to. Here is a king that you want to be on the right side of. Verse 9 actually sets forth two alternatives, two options for the nations to consider, though these options are usually lost in modern translations. The word break could just as easily be translated shepherd, and so what we would have here would be a choice between firm shepherding under the king's rule or devastating destruction in revolting against that rule. And these two options, to serve or to perish, become the focus of the last stanza. So we'll turn our attention there. The warning to the nations. Therefore, you kings, be wise, be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear. Celebrate his rule with trembling. Kiss the Son, or he will be angry, and your way will lead to your destruction. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. Here at the conclusion, the rulers of the nations are admonished to wise up and accept the reality of their situation. Resistance to God is futile, and they must submit to him with appropriate respect, acknowledge his rightful authority, and obey his law. The expression kiss the son simply means, again, to pay homage to, as in kissing the feet of a king, or his ring, or perhaps the helm of his royal robe. It is a sign of submission and allegiance. This submission is called for given the risk of the king's wrath flaring up unexpectedly. And so appropriately enough, the psalm ends with a striking contrast. On the one hand, the rebellious are admonished to submit to the king to avoid the angry outpouring of his wrath and destruction. And on the other hand, those who acknowledge God's rightful authority and power over their lives find refuge in him and are considered blessed. In Psalm 2, we see that at the center of history isn't the struggle of great world powers for superiority or even existence, as we might think when we read our history books. At the center of history is God, whose relationship with the earthly powers will determine their ultimate destiny. And like Psalm 1, Psalm 2 offers us the encouragement we need to not panic or lose heart when we see things around us falling apart. We should not be surprised by what is going on, for instance, in our culture at the present time, how it is ramping up its rebellion and hostility toward the Lord, its law, and his people. This psalm is essentially, I mean, when you think about it, a poetic dramatization of that truth we hold so dear in Romans 8. If God is for us, who could be against us? If God is for us, who could possibly pose any genuine, lasting threat? All right, before we leave this psalm, we should consider for a moment here in closing the relationship that it has with the book of Psalms, with book 1 of the Psalms, and with Psalm 1. So a little quiz regarding material we covered last week. How is the book of Psalms divided? John? Okay, we have five books. We have five collections. Very good. And there they are. Psalm 2 belongs to what book? This is really tough. Okay, book 1. How many books are in Psalm 1? Or how many psalms are in, I'm dyslexic, how many psalms are in book 1? Again, the answer, see how easy I make it for you guys. All right. So now think back, what do we know about book 1? In particular, what do we know about the tone or the themes that are common in book 1 of the Psalms? Okay, we have a number of laments. Remember what a lament is? Complaining to God about a particular situation, calling upon him for help, sometimes being frustrated that this help is not coming fast enough. There is a number of references to the problem with evil in the world. There's references to suffering. We have imprecatory statements. It has kind of a dark tone. Not all the Psalms are that way, but a lot of the more, a lot of these psalms that wrestle with injustice are found in book 1. Last week, we spent time on how Psalm 1 serves as a fitting introduction to not just the whole Psalter, but also to book 1 of the Psalter. The fact is, Psalm 2 has been seen in the same way. In fact, both Psalm 1 and Psalm 2 are typically considered to be a pair. They go together. And they start together, they start the psalm off on certain fundamental truths that must always be kept in mind. Yes, there will be injustice. Evil will oftentimes triumph. The righteous will often suffer and so on. But in the end, God will have his way and all will be made right. He is sovereign, and we cannot forget that when going through hardship, especially when being the victim of injustice. So, this is especially appropriate for book 1 of the Psalter. Now, though the styles are very different, the two psalms do have a common promise. The one who is faithful to God will be blessed. This is how Psalm 1 starts off in the very first verse, and it is how Psalm 2 ends with the very last verse. In fact, interestingly enough, I won't get into a whole discussion here, but in some ancient manuscripts, both Psalms, Psalm 1 and 2, are actually joined together as one psalm because of that. Yet the two are really quite different. Psalm 1 is a didactic poem, a wisdom poem that is intended to teach, exhort, instruct. It appeals to one's common sense, to one's mind. Psalm 2 is a royal or kingship psalm. It's a drama intended to both sober us and encourage us. And this primarily through provoking our emotions. But yet they complement each other so well, and in this they really do set the stage for the psalms that follow. And this is especially seen in how each emphasizes the two major forces in the life of Israel. Psalm 1 highlights God's law, the importance of his righteous ways, his divine wisdom for our lives. Psalm 2 highlights God's divine plan, the importance of prophecy, his commitment to do what he says he will do. The law is the foundation. Prophecy builds on that. And this is what we see throughout the Psalms that follow, what God has said in the past and what God has promised to do in the future. All right, so next Sunday, what do you think we might take on next Sunday? Psalm 3? Well, that would be a logical assumption to make, but you're assuming that I'm starting a series on the Psalms. I haven't really said that, so we'll keep that as a big mystery for now. something you can all talk about on Facebook. Geez, are we in a song, in a series or not? All right. Well, they'll get all kinds of hits, won't it? All right. Next Sunday, of course, is Mother's Day. And I don't have a Mother's Day message in particular planned, but I do have something close, a message for parents. I'm going to combine Mother's Day and Father's Day together. And in that, we'll probably be using some of the Psalms in that message, but not Psalm 3. So if you want to read ahead, you can. Just read Psalms 1 through 150, and you'll be all set to go. Be good to go. All right, why don't we stand at this time and have the, I forgot to ring the bell. Yeah. And we'll have the musicians come forward, and we're going to begin with two hymns that are fitting for today's message. The first one is See the Conqueror, which speaks for itself. It's very rich, and the one to follow that will be Praise to the Lord the Almighty. And just point you to verse 3 of that song. Praise to the Lord who in darkness of sin is abounding, who when the godless do triumph, all virtue confounding. And this psalm, along with See the Conqueror and Psalm 2, all point us in the right direction of how we should think about those sorts of things.